Okay, Nick, I'm excited to have you on. This is an experiment. I've got this new idea here, the Ultimate Aviators Podcast. So you're the inaugural guest. The plan here, the thesis of the podcast or whatever, is to master our craft in aviation and then also to demystify the industry because it's got a high barrier of entry, and if you're not sure where to get started, it can be pretty intimidating. So anyway, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Johnny. And I feel like when you're this blows up and gets big and famous, I'll be like, I was the very first person. So appreciate it.
It'll be a fun experiment, but like ultimately I think we're just excited about aviation and that's why we're here. So as long as it's fun and cool and we can learn something, I think that's the whole point and would be considered success. And you know, who knows what it looks like in the future. It might just be a short trial run, but I figured I'd reach out to a couple people that are in aviation industry that maybe have a unique perspective on things and kind of pair a unique guest to an interesting question that helps pull back the curtain a little bit on how aviation works. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your company and who you represent and what you do?
So about 10 years ago, I invented a smart view limiting device for weather training called the Icarus device, or the Instrument Conditions Awareness Recognition Understanding System. So I've been working on that for the past 10 years of my life. Basically, I spend most of my days talking to pilots now all over the world, all different types of operators, everything from, for example, I just sent a device to a small flight school in Ireland, or excuse me, a flying club. So, you know, they've been around for 50, 60 years. They got a couple little airplanes versus, you know, operators. I sent one recently last month to a big oil and gas operator that works for Exxon in Australia that flies, you know, $20 million helicopters. So that's the cool part of the job is that I get to work with pilots from all over, all walks of life, all parts of the world. And get them good training, or get them the tool to so that they can do good training.
That's cool. Obviously, I sell a physical product in the aviation industry as well, but nothing as high tech as yours. I've worn it. It's like a plastic visor that clips in either onto a ball cap or on a flight helmet, and then it's got a button where you can change the setting or even the Bluetooth connection to use the app, right?
Yeah, we just updated the app, trying to focus a little bit more on the weather decision-making training aspect of what we do. It's been a kind of a very iterative design process if you ever went to engineering school. I never in a million years when I was sitting in class just trying to hang on thought that I would do what I did and would go down that path. It's not a rocket ship. It's not a... an airplane or anything like that. It's been a wild ride still.
Yeah. So then can you tell us a little bit more about, I say us as if anyone's listening, can you tell me and whoever catches this later, tell me more about your journey in aviation and what that looked like, what sparked the interest? I think we're in a unique industry where even if you have no intention of ever flying, everyone who hears something flying outside looks up.
And yeah.
When we walk into a room, people like to ask us questions because we typically have one of the cooler jobs. So what got you started in aviation and how have you taken that passion to the next level through starting a company?
I was that kid that built, you know, balsa wood models and model rockets and, read all the magazine articles at the time. My dad had gone to Purdue as well for aeronautical engineering and ended up working in the telecommunications industry. But so he definitely imparted a lot of that on me. Somebody's got to fix your stuff when you glue your super glue your fingers together, which I did a bunch as a kid. When I turned 16, my mom could not deal with me both driving and flying. So, I think after I was 17, she, finally let me start getting hours in like a Cessna 172 over at Bergstrom Airport in Austin. So, you know, I was delivering pizzas in college to get hours and finally worked up and got my rating. I do very much agree that there's almost too much barriers to entry, and I think the industry is in a transition right now. Like, do we really need to be introducing kids to, you know, the 1972 Cessna 172? Not that the 172 is not a great aircraft. It just, we need more modern, safer trainers that are also more cost efficient. But ended up going to Purdue like my dad, and went to struggled through aeronautical engineering, and hung in there and fought the good fight, and finally came away 4.5 years later, a changed person and with a degree, and then went into the military and learned. That's where I learned to fly helicopters, and then here I am, and been. Kind of taking a crazy path, you know. In the military, we often talk about the golden path. I fell off it many, many years ago. So now I mostly fly helicopters, but I've been getting into light aircraft again, looking to get my instructor rating and start teaching. And kind of, you know, not out there to build hours or hop to the airlines, but would like to give people their first flights and stuff like that. And teach. So
yeah, oh that's sweet. I have similar aspirations. So I did mechanical engineering and wanted to work building things that fly. My school didn't have aerospace engineering, but I kind of found the classes that made sense. I came back from flight school, also military, but my plan was to focus on helicopter flying, and I applied for some of the credentialing assistance to get my fixed wing ratings. Mm-hmm. I never ended up pursuing it. They've still got the money in an account waiting for me to get started, but my thought was if I can introduce my two girls to flying, that would be something that we can do together and then build their confidence, which like, what kid doesn't want to fly? And then I feel like on top of that, right, as a girl dad, thinking about ways I can expose them to different things, where I had Boy Scouts as a kid, maybe we can go flying, and that's a skill set I can possibly pass along. So that's a down the road Johnny problem. Not right.
Yeah. Now. Yeah. And I highly encourage you to get up in a light aircraft. It's not necessarily for everybody. It's a cool skill, and it allows you to sometimes view aviation in a different way when so many aircraft are working aircraft, where you can just go up and have fun on a nice evening, or go see somebody, or go visit somewhere. But, you know, you kind of have to have that safety focus, especially if you're taking a loved one. My wife is not necessarily the biggest fan of flying, but I'll tell you a little funny story. Up where I met her, I had gotten checked out and had actually used some credentialing assistance and was up on a Cirrus, and it wasn't anything new or, you know, but, you know, it's a nicer aircraft built in this millennium. And she had never been up in one, and, you know, sat there and explained to her, you know, here's where the parachute is. You know, if anything happens to me, that's what you do. And the cockpit of it is very much like a modern car. And even though she had some doubts and some anxiety, she felt comfortable enough to go flying with me. But we're coming back, and there was one of those flight school 152s that's, you know, 50, 60 years old probably, and just been, you know, beat up. And I was like, check this out. This is what I learned to fly on. And, you know, went up there and popped the door open and let her poke her head in, and the seats don't match, and, you know, the panels all mismatched, and, you know, it's got some duct tape. And she looks back up at me, and I'll never forget, and she's like, if you would have taken me out here and been like, hop in, let's go, I wouldn't have gone. So it's very important to you know, when somebody's going flying with you, they're putting their faith in you to get them home safely. So it's our duty as pilots to kind of make sure people feel safe and Obviously, people read the headlines, and you know, crashes make headlines, unfortunately. But yeah, it's great to share.
I feel like it's something that people don't think about, and right, like it's sexy to fly operational missions or mm-hmm. do the cool scenic flights. But yeah, they don't go without the maintenance to back it up.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. There's so many things that go into it. I'm reading a book now about, you know, the 100 years ago, the aviation industry, and, you know, it's just wooden canvas and, you know, rudimentary engines in the seat of your pants. So we've come a long way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, both of us being engineers, I look up to Igor Sikorsky, and I'm just like, mad respect, dude. I would never be the first person to be like, I think the theory's there to auto-rotate.
Yeah.
Try to cut my engine and land this thing.
Yeah. So,
or even just sitting underneath a rotor disc unprotected, like the amount of pioneering they did. I'm just like, well, there's no chance.
And the crazy thing about Igor, because I'm a huge fan, you know, in Tsarist Russia, he built the first four-engine aircraft at a time where materials were not, you know, you didn't even have metals that you could use for structures and stuff like that. And then he came over here and he had an extremely successful career designing flying boats. And, you know, 100 years ago, flying boats made a ton of sense because there weren't airports everywhere. But there's, you know, like the Navy always says that, you know, 70% of the earth is water. And he had been very successful, but then the industry just moved to land-based. There's no way you can make a flying boat that can go as fast as and far as a comparable land-based aircraft. So that it was United, gosh, I'm thinking of the conglomerate that sold it to Lockheed Martin a few years ago. But anyways, they came to him and they were like, we're really sorry, Igor. Like, we're going to have to shut the line down. Is there anything you want to do? And he had been in like the 1910s, 30 years prior, had been working on helicopters. And it had always fascinated him. And there had been some developments. You know, engines had gotten better, materials had gotten better. But nobody had ever solved making a helicopter that could really, truly operate. So he's like, I want to build a helicopter. And they had the faith in him to be like, here's the checkbook, go make it happen. But you know, you see the pictures of him with his hat, and that's pretty much it under those first helicopters.
Yeah.
with the blades not very far away from that hat.
No concept of fog.
No. My favorite, he in those original videos of you see him, and he's flying around with the just the hat on. He slowed those videos down to show the board and investors, because if you were to speed it up to real speed, the controls were not really worked out. We didn't understand a tremendous amount about helicopter aerodynamics, so it was much more unstable than it looked if you sped it up into real time. But you know, he had a dream, he had a vision, and I think. You can't argue it didn't come true. Helicopters are out there saving lives every day, which is another cool part. I mean, what I love about the helicopter industry is whether you're doing search and rescue or firefighting or law enforcement helicopter ambulance, whatever it is, you know, the helicopter is a working vehicle that, you know, gets tough stuff done.
Yeah, it's crazy. The guy known for helicopter innovation broke world records with planes first and set him up to do a helicopter.
Yeah.
Well, like getting back to your core competency here. So your device is meant to train instrument conditions.
Yes.
So kind of the goal, I think, of this is pairing the guest with a question, right? So the one I've got for you that I think you're uniquely fit to answer is, how can aviators build confidence in and around weather?
So I think the first thing is you've got to lay that, you've got to demystify it and understand weather phenomenon and nuances, but as they relate to flying. I think that you can go get a meteorology degree and how different things happen, but there's all sorts of little things that you pick up. For example, you know, you're flying along, you're in a rural part of the country, there's not a lot of weather information possibly available, but you can get the temperature and dew point. Is the sun setting? Start worrying about fog. Stuff like that, those little things that you pick up as you kind of understand how it relates to flying more. So first off, you've got to have kind of that base level knowledge of actual weather and how things work. The second, I think, from my foxhole, definitely you've got to do good training for it. And one of the things I'm trying to change is, you know, you sit there at the table before you go fly with your flight instructor when you're learning instruments specifically. You know, they're going to sit there and be like, okay, you have this visibility and this ceiling. Can you go do that approach? You know, would you go, would you not go? And it's very black and white and it's easy. You know, it's not easy. It's a simple answer. Whereas in the real world, there's few simple answers. And the most important weather decisions you're going to make are most likely going to be in the aircraft as you've been getting along the mission. If you look at like accident reports, what you kind of get a sense of is, you know, people are almost to their destination. They're getting there. They're getting closer. So then that there's this bias of, okay, well, I can make it. And you end up not being able to make it. So getting good, accurate training is my whole thing. So giving people the chance to see, you know, a breakout at MINS into marginal visual conditions, which is how an instrument approach is going to go, versus, you know, hey, are you prepared for the gut punch of going inadvertent instrument meteorological conditions or VFR into IMC or UIMC, whatever we're calling it. Because that's a sensory mismatch that can be overpowering. And if you're not prepared for it, that transition is going to be very tough. So getting good training, and one of the things we're really trying to do is give people a baseline of, hey, this is what 3 miles looks like, so they have some reference points. And then kind of going forward, out of the initial training, you know, obviously getting good recurrent training is always good. Organizationally, organizational factors are huge. Is it a flight organization that's like, we fly when it's clear blue 22 and that's it? Or is it one that's like, you know, don't be a wimp, go push the weather? Both are bad, but you know, the answer is somewhere in the middle. And I know I've gotten myself into a situation or two where it's like, yeah, we probably should have turned around if I, you know, and this isn't, you know, I'm at the edge of my comfort zone. Years ago, I had an instructor explain to me the concept of like each pilot, you have your box of things that you will do. And overlaid in that is like, what can the aircraft actually do? So the aircraft can do all sorts of stuff. I bet you I could take a aircraft that says no aerobatics and go out there and do some aerobatics in it if I did it perfectly in the box. So as you go along and as you, you know, put those hours in the logbook, not just the hours, but you get more experiences in that box kind of changes. And in some areas it's going to expand, in some areas it's going to contract. For example, like if we're on the ground and there's no really pressing reason, unless there's an extremely pressing reason, if there's a maintenance issue or something like that, man, I'll fly another day. Whereas, you know, if you're young, you're eager, you don't want to, you know, look like you're shirking flying, maybe you would have pushed it. So, but also like for bad weather specifically, like, you know, once you get comfortable flying in the instrument environment, it can be a very, calm place on instruments. You know what's going to happen. I know exactly how I'm going to get sequenced in to fly this approach. You know, a lot of aircraft today are very capable with autopilots. And if you are a good manager and if you are a good procedural person and you've foreseen everything, it can be an extremely calm, some people even prefer it, versus, you know, down in the dirt, you know, close, watching out for birds and other aircraft and stuff like that. But if you're unprepared for it, if you don't have the experience, it can seem a little bit hectic, and you can't see outside a lot of the time, so that also sucks. So I think those kind of three things, I kind of broke it up into those three buckets: the understanding of what's happening, the good training and foundational training, and then you know, how does your operational environment, and then as you grow, shape what does that box look like? What will you do as a pilot, and what won't you do? I don't know. Is there anything you can think of that you would say, I'm not going to do that anymore? Or, you know, maybe you would have been scared to do it when you were brand new?
Well, yeah. So you brought up a bunch of core memories and flight training experience, right? I've only ever flown helicopters, and I went through the Army flight school. So, yes, I'm in the military, but I'm not speaking on behalf of the military. And, you know, my opinions are my own. The standard disclaimer, right? But I remember struggling through the primary phase of flight school really hard because I wasn't the kid who had always wanted to fly, and everything was new to me. And I didn't jive with my instructor very well. And then my stick buddy, the student I was paired with, was from Germany, who was already like very selective in their application process and chosen from a batch that wanted to be pilots. And, you know, he would tell me all the time, oh, in America, everyone can be a pilot. Like, look at our class right now. I'm one of 100 selected to be here.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I remember really struggling in primary. And then as soon as I got to basic instruments, I was like, oh, this is very procedural. And as long as I understand the process, I am definitely a systems-oriented guy. And so that was confidence boosting because, yes, there's decision making that needs to happen, but a lot of it is, if you just, like you said, understand your aircraft, but then also understand the regulations, then really there's not a lot that is an issue. And I guess a second experience that it triggered in your stories was I had freshly made pilot in command, and I was flying with like a relatively experienced pilot, but who is not yet a pilot in command. And we were like, hey, what do you want to do today? And there's an airport that just started selling these really good burritos. So we're like, well, let's go there. And we could do instruments on the way down and VFR on the way back. And weather was kind of skosh, and we had to cross over like a mountain divide to get there. So we're like, we'll see. And I remember at the table, he was just like, do you think we should go down there? And right, like, now pilot in command, it's my decision. Obviously, like, crew mix, but, you know, I'll be held accountable to whatever we decide to do and how it turns up, right? But I just remember being like, hey, man, like, we're both instrument-rated pilots, right? We're already deciding to file IFR to get down there. We have the weather to cancel IFR and come back VFR if we don't like what we're seeing. So, like, we might as well try. And I remember getting to just north of the Colorado Springs airport, and they are like, it's a wall of fog, you know, up as we can see and totally to the ground. And they're just like, I've got Southwest Airlines in holding patterns on the south side of the airport right now because they can't get in. We're like, okay, yeah, we'll cancel IFR. We'd like to proceed VFR. And so we like tried, and anyway, it just, yeah, we were like, yeah, there's not really like any urgency to get through this. And it was still a confidence booster to be like, we're going to go IFR, and if we don't like what we could see, we could always cancel. But, like, military pilots are notoriously bad at flying IFR.
And you know, how much do you actually do it? That's the big thing. It's like, what you know, you have a certain – every aircraft has a certain amount of tasks it can do, and then, you know, what you're actually going to be out there doing with it. And it's like, it can do it. It's very capable, but how often do you need to? So good on you for like going out there and maybe trying something where it's easier to just say, I guess we could stay here. So it's a balance between, you don't want to be too gung ho and trying to take the world on. But also you don't want to be $100 hamburger pilot. Not that there's anything wrong with that. And I know plenty of them that are good, safe, competent pilots. But some of us want more, you know, like to be able to go out there and do a mission. If you want to go do a mission, you've got to kind of take a professional approach to it. And that's something that I kind of, you know, I deal with a lot of very experienced professional pilots, but I also deal with general aviation pilots, people who own an airplane, and it's a business and a personal thing. And most of them already come with it, but sometimes in talking to them, it's like, you need to treat it professionally no matter what. Give aviation its due. You obviously understood the situation pretty good that day, and you gave yourself an out. I think that's the important part, is not necessarily, you can't predict the weather, or you can look at it. You can plan a pretty picnic, but the important part, and this isn't just a weather thing, this is a, you know, can I pick up, you know, something with a helicopter? Can I, what happens if I can't? What is your out? Is an important part. And one of the things about Icarus that I like that as a tool builder is I can make you, okay, let's talk about your out, or you better have been planning an out because I'm going to make you take it. You know, with Inadvertent IMC, you know, there's some acronyms you can remember, and you can give it lip service. I would just transition to instruments and squawk 7700 and call up approach and shoot an ILS. Okay, that's a good plan, but let's dive deeper. If you actually went Inadvertent IMC, okay, you're going to climb. What are you going to climb at? One thing that will give you spatial disorientation very, very quickly is not just losing your visuals, it's large, rapid power changes and attitude changes in the aircraft. So in a helicopter, it's even worse because, you know, an airplane is essentially just getting pushed or pulled along. But that disc that's on, you know, above your head can pull you in all sorts of directions. And especially if you're light, if you pull in an armpit full of collective, you're gonna start getting illusions very quickly. So being able to tie all that stuff in, you know, how much torque are you actually going to pull in? What airspeed are you going to climb out at? When are you going to start trying to talk to somebody and divide your attention from flying the aircraft? So making sure people, you know, aren't just giving lip service to their out.
Yeah, and it's something I've paid a lot more attention to lately as well, because being a Colorado-based pilot, we regularly either have to climb to 10 or 12 or 14,000 feet just to avoid obstacles, because we're right on the front range of the Continental Divide. And, you know, it might not be as easy as, well, I'll just climb 2,000 feet because there are peaks all around you, and you might be in a valley where it's 12,000 feet on either side of you. And, you know, really, how are you going to do this? And so a lot of it for us is very situational. And anyway, yeah, exercising the contingency plans are a huge way to not just show that you've prepared and, like, sure, there's the legality and the smart decision making, but I also think it's a huge confidence booster, right? If you go into every situation, you're like, these are all the things I could run into, and here's the planning that I've done to be ready for it, then, like, the odds of you having to do something that you haven't planned for are probably pretty small, but you've already, like, built up your own confidence as a pilot saying, I can do this, and I know what I'm supposed to do, and I put in the time to be ready, and maybe something pops up that you aren't ready for, but you could stay calm and collected through a lot of that just by doing the initial legwork.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that it comes with experience, like the being able to kind of foresee. And one thing I don't do, and I've had these conversations with people, it's like, there's a debate of, well, do you start, you know, if you experience bad weather, do you turn around? Do you descend? Do you climb? What do you do? And it's like, it depends. I can't give you a blanket statement. If you're in an instrument rated aircraft with, and your instrument current, and you know it's a non-convective cloud, it's a gentle pillow cloud. Have at it. Are you in Kansas or are you in Colorado? That's a big, you know, it's a big difference. I'm very lucky that the one time I went inadvertent, or it was somewhat advertent, I didn't have anything I could hit. I knew I couldn't hit anything. And there was two of us, and, you know, we got through it. I wasn't happy about it, but, you know, I knew that if we stayed there, we weren't going to hit anything. So you've kind of just got to make those decision points. There's a term in the helicopter ambulance industry that they've been getting more widespread, you know, in-route decision points. You know, we get to this, you know, over this valley, and if we can't see X, we're going to turn around or stuff like that. So I think it's important to do that. And I also, I'm a big fan. I think it was Eisenhower who said, plans are worthless, but planning is everything. So.
Yeah. Sweet, man. This has been awesome. I've learned a lot, and I'm excited for what you're doing with Icarus. I've played around with the device, so it's cool. We're already at 30 minutes, so.
Yeah.
Also with a couple of fun questions. Okay, what do you most often fly?
I mostly fly helicopters, but I've been gotten in a little Rimas GX, which is a German 100 horsepower, two-seat carbon fiber, high wing, ultra lights, what we call light sport aircraft. So, you know, it's fun to fly in a t-shirt and shorts, and been slowly working up to that. So, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I can't imagine what it'd be like to be one of those tuna boat pilots where you're in flip flops or barefoot, Hawaiian shirt with no doors, just looking for tuna.
Yeah, yeah. I always try and wear close-toed shoes, but I have been flying it in. I do Hawaiian shirt Fridays because when we work from home and you know, jobs can be stressful. You've got to do stuff too. That's fun. So I wear a Hawaiian shirt every Friday. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. One of my instructors for a professional military education, he exclusively wears Hawaiian shirts, and then he was talking about how his whole closet, he's converting it all to wooden hangers to get all his Hawaiian shirts perfect.
Yeah, nice, nice. Fun plug for anybody that has a... You can actually go and get custom Hawaiian shirts, and they're not too expensive. So I've got one with some helicopters and my logo on it. But.
I'll have to look into that. That sounds cool.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite airport you've been to, or FBO?
There's quite a few I could think of. I love Austin Bergstrom International Airport because that's where I learned to fly. There's a little airport called Lakeway, which is out where I grew up. I actually just flew out there to give one of my friend's sons a little toy. His parents live right there, and he was on pre-deployment leave, so. Flew that little Rimas up there. I will say favorite place to fly into is not an airport, but it's a vertiport in Chicago in Little Italy. So a little bit more of a varsity level thing to get in there and out of there, but you know, beautiful Chicago skyline. So yeah, and you get to fly along the lake and you know, get to rock and roll and you know, some big man-made obstacles around there. So,
yeah, city flying can be super intimidating, but like when you have looked into it and have your plan figured out and all that, it's really cool. You just look down and it's full of people, and you're like, man,
like, yeah.
Do they even realize I'm up here?
I think
it's super rewarding to like fly over Denver and just be like, man, how many people get to do this? And I'm just totally comfortable. Like, oh yeah, there's the Broncos Stadium. Like, seen that a bajillion times.
Yeah, yeah, you got to kind of never take it for granted. Never take the magic for granted.
Okay, one last fun one. What do you dream of flying someday?
Unrealistically, I would have loved to have flown the space shuttle. I think it's such a crazy cool problem. I've got a little bit of glider time. I need to finish up my glider rating. You know, coming in that fast and managing the energy all the way down is super cool. Fun fact, they built an in-aircraft trainer. They took a business jet and turned it into a trainer which I've used in some of my promotional stuff, as like even NASA realized that the best training is simulators are the ones that fly. More realistically, because I don't think anybody's going to fly the space shuttle anymore, I would love to... It's kind of been on the burner for a while of like, hey, let's go get our float plane ratings with some buddies of mine. But I would love to fly like a big flying boat, like a Martin Mars or something like that.
That'd be cool. I grew up, speaking of core memories that you bring up, you're just getting all of the Johnny when he was younger stories. But I grew up in Northern Virginia, so I remember being outside watching the space shuttle being flown on top of the commercial airliner.
Yeah.
And then just going to the Udvar-Hazy Air and Space Smithsonian right there and seeing a space shuttle in the museum. It is wild.
Yeah.
No, I'm getting my stories mixed up. They have an SR-71 there. I don't think the space shuttle's in Udvar-Hazy.
They have both.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I can't remember which one it is, but they've got one there. I need to check my list because I'm a nerd. I've seen, there's one in LA and there's one obviously in DC there.
Well, but, the SR-71 is my unrealistic fly because I don't have any. I love flying helicopters. I don't aspire to the airlines either, but man, to go that fast and then also I just love big engineering problems and the amount of effort that got thrown into the SR-71 or the space shuttle or any of these just crazy non-standard aircraft are so fascinating to me.
Yeah, and hopefully we're having a bit of a renaissance of people who are taking on huge, huge problems in aviation now. Well, cool. Well, awesome, Johnny. Well, hey, I really appreciate being your first guest and looking forward to seeing this thing take off.
Yeah, tons of fun. Thanks for coming on, Nick, and we'll catch up another time.
Sweet.
See ya.
Bye.